This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Our next speakers are going to address a subject with which I have probably more experience than I'd like to confess to. I have failed at establishing multidisciplinary centers more than most people have tried. I failed in a large scale at least three times. So I'm keen to hear what Professor Mills and Professor Rowe have to tell us about how to build a multidisciplinary program. Vince?
Thank you. So when I was asked to give this talk, I said, well, I have to give my one disclosure. And the big disclosure is we don't have a formal limb preservation program. So, my talk needed to be reworded to how did we realize that we needed to build a multidisciplinary program. And so, I'm going to basically talk about that, you know, what had to kind of shoot us, hit us in the face and throw cold water at us to help us wake up that we needed to do that. Dr. Mills can get more into the nuts and bolts, as well as Dr. Angeles probably, because they've had successful programs. So the first thing we realized was volume, and this wasn't even just at the times of the trial that I talked about earlier. We realized that we had the volume of patients. We were taking care of a lot of patients with critical limb disease, and the volume was consistent, and it seemed to be growing. It was actually very diverse, too, which was somewhat interesting. You know, Los Angeles is a very diverse community, but we were seeing critical limb ischemia in all patients. You named their ethnicity. They were presenting to us with critical limb issues. And a big diabetic population. It was much bigger than I had ever seen. Now, this is me back in 1999. I'm graduating from the University of Tennessee, and I love the place. I was a Los Angeles guy, but I enjoyed my fellowship. And going down there is where I learned to love college football because it's a big part of Knoxville, Tennessee. Everything shuts down for college football. And it was actually the first time I had ever seen the leaves change. I'd never seen this in my life. So me and my wife, we spent a lot of time in my research year going up to the mountains and taking pictures of this because it was just fascinating to us. But when I came back to Los Angeles, I said, whoa, this is something that I haven't seen before. All of the bypasses we were doing in Tennessee were basically maybe to below the knee. The lowest was mid-calf, usually smokers with femoral popliteal disease. And this influx of diabetics and lower tibial disease was completely new to me. And we hadn't seen any of these feet like this in my fellowship. So this was kind of shocking to me once I got to Los Angeles County. And like I talked about, there's a big diversity there. And as you can see, the ones that had the highest rates of diabetes and the highest issues were the ones that had the worst outcomes. So it was pretty shocking to have to try to take care of these patients at this point. But the volume just stayed consistent, and now I think it's probably about over 90-95% of our patients there with presenting with critical limb ischemia are diabetic. And the numbers for diabetes are great. I always enjoy the diabetic people that present these fantastic and resounding numbers. I think Dr. Mills said every 17 or 20 seconds. I mean, there's all these numbers that can try to make you understand the impact. I don't know if it's translated across the population because we don't have a band for diabetes. We don't really have a nice lapel pin that we can wear like for autism last month. But still, the impact is huge. Team. Well, that's going to be talked about more often. And we've tried to have that approach. And we've finally, like I said, realize that they've been talking about a team approach for years. Dr. Harkless mentioned Dr. Jocelyn from New England Deaconess Hospital, who pretty much set up one of the first multidisciplinary clinics for diabetic care. And it was interesting what he said back then. Gangrene worsened with age, the incidence of it, as well as duration of diabetes and in uncontrolled patients. And we see that all the way now, fast forward about 60, 70 years, it's still occurring. We talked about our CLI team, and yeah, that's in place, but I think for us to have a great multidisciplinary approach, we need to kind of expand that team. Now, this is a case that was sent to me after the patient was quote-unquote debrided, and it was the most extensive debridement I had ever seen. Now, the podiatrist will probably need to close their eyes because they're going to cringe. I didn't have a podiatrist to help take care of this with me. And our foot and ankle guy didn't really care about any of these kind of diabetic patients. So I know we're going to need that. We're going to need either a great podiatrist or a foot and ankle person that has an interest, because it's going to be an impact. So I went ahead and revascularized him, and actually the toes turned a little bit worse. But I was happy to just say, well, here's a little bit of granulation tissue coming out. At that point, I was like, okay, well, where are my plastic surgeons? Who's going to come and help? Should I flap this? What do I do with all these exposed bones? I had no idea. So I just went and just took everything off. And you can see here the exposed bones. Like I said, podiatrist, I know that's a bad thing. But it was just sitting there. I didn't know what else to do. I got the wound care team involved. Infectious disease tried to help. And we were ordering an MRI. There was obviously stuff in the marrow. It was obvious osteo that was exposed. And what we were really going to need now is nutrition, because this gentleman, his blood sugars were off the chart. He didn't understand diet. We needed physical therapy. I wasn't sure if this was a functional foot. We needed a prosthetist. And, you know, we needed an endocrinologist to help him control his sugar. So this was one case where, you know, I kind of fumbled through it. I don't know if it was right. But we really needed a wound care specialist, and that's when it finally started hitting us that we need to do something. And I think the wound care team is not just isolated to critical limb ischemia from diabetes. I think it's trauma also, like our plastic surgeon this morning said. This was a 6-year-old girl that was somehow got run over by the lawnmower that was operated by her father. And you can see the extensive, it was a popliteal injury for us. Yeah, we were able to go ahead and repair that. And orthopedics was able to come in, but the soft tissue defects, she's going to need big help with plastic surgery and coverage, as well as some way to rehabilitate and get back on her feet, because it's going to be a long rehabilitative process for this young girl. The bottom line, yeah, the hospital says, yeah, that's all great. You want all these people, but, you know, what's it going to do for us? And I think that's going to be one of our hurdles. How are we going to facilitate reimbursement, professional fees, growth, potential, and so forth, and make it worth everyone's while? And so I know there's going to be a lot of hurdles that are still in place, and especially the fact, you know, OR time, we're talking about bringing in extra people and having cases and shared, so forth, research availability, data management. And these are all things that we're trying to think through, but at least now we finally started the process. So hopefully next year, if I come back to talk to you again, I'm already advertising for my presence, but by then, we should have something in place in terms of our limb salvage team. Thank you.
Next to the podium is Dr. Joe Mills from Baylor in Houston, who will tell us about his program both in Tucson and in Houston. Joe.
Thank you. There's going to be almost no science in this, and I'll try not to overlap too much, but this model kind of grew out of just observations that took me a long time to make. And again, I used this slide earlier, but so when I trained in the Air Force in vascular surgery, it was a really strong vascular program, and we did a lot of aortic surgery and carotid surgery and very few limbs. I only saw one vessel below the knee in my entire residency experience. I did 33 open aortic reconstructions in 3 months as a chief resident. And I did about that many carotids. And all of a sudden, I landed. So the year I applied for vascular surgery fellowships was the year they were first accredited by the ACGME. So all the programs I'd applied to weren't accredited yet. And I found this one in Oregon that was accredited, and I went up there and interviewed with John Porter and got accepted. So I go up there expecting to do aortas and carotids and all that fun stuff, and we have leg after leg. I did 100 distal bypasses with Dr. Porter, 104, something like that, as a fellow. And so when I went back to the Air Force, I said, well, that's all cool, but we don't have distal disease here. You're not going to see that. So good luck with that. So the year I was a fellow was the year that Bandick wrote the paper on graft duplex scanning. So I started looking around, and we had a transplant service. We had a lot of renal failure patients, a lot of diabetics. And I just started asking the internist and the orthopedist and the general surgeons that if they had a diabetic foot, let us just see it. So within about 6 months, they were admitting them all to our service. And after a while, we'd have 15 or 20 patients like that on our service, and we pretty much started doing lots of legs. So That's when I started the first multidisciplinary thing. So let me skip over some of these because we talked about them. So then I moved to Arizona, same thing. It was mostly relatively modest practice of aortas and carotids and a few legs, and we got that going pretty quickly because there was demographics on our side. So we had lots of Hispanics, lots of elderly, because lots of people moved to the Southwest to retire. So aging and being Hispanic increased your risk of having diabetes. And then we had Native American populations we served, some of which are almost all diabetic. So I started working in the same way I always had and realized a couple things, that we were only seeing part of the, even though we were busy, we weren't seeing all the patients that could potentially help. And then we were missing a key component. So I would do, for example, a femme perineal on somebody with an infected foot after I drained it, get their transmet to heal, might require a skin graft like that case that Vince showed, and then see the guy back every 3 months for a year, every 6 months for 2 years, and periodically to monitor his bypass graft with surveillance. And then I'd notice he had a sore on the bottom of his foot, and his foot was in Aquinas, and he was walking on it. And I thought, geez, I don't know how to take care of this stuff. And so we hired David Armstrong. So we started working together, and it dawned on me about this time that if you're going to do this, you really need to partner with somebody that gets the foot. And I learned a lot about the foot on my own, but I'm still not the same as a podiatrist. And podiatrists pay attention to blood flow, but they don't think about blood flow the same way that vascular surgeons do. So why not partner up on every patient? And the other reason that's important is I think that the disease has changed. So when I trained with Dr. Porter, we did patients with diabetes, but we still had a lot of patients that were just smokers. And it was a pure plumbing problem, pure ischemia problem. And it took me years to figure this out, but I kept thinking, patients are changing, and the disease pattern was changing. We'll get to the next talk a little bit. But that there's not so many patients that are just neuropathic anymore. A lot of these patients are neuroischemic, right? So when I first started doing the diabetic feet, most of the patients, we just drained their infection, offloaded them a little bit, took off a dead toe from infection, they healed. And through all those patients, we filtered out the few that needed bypass. Then I started noticing that more and more of them were needing bypasses. Then I started noticing that endo was happening, so try to figure that out. So it seemed to me you needed to add the component of things that the vascular surgeons don't do. So we did that in Arizona. I'll show you a little bit of data on that. And then there's a couple papers. So actually one of the impetuses to the whole thing of the toe and flow model, when David and I were talking, he got invited to give a talk. So those of you who know David, he talks a lot. And he travels a lot. But he said, hey, I'm going to this talk, and it's all about vascular disease and diabetes. And this is cool. And I said, well, let me look at the pamphlet. And he shows me the pamphlet, and there wasn't one vascular surgeon on that pamphlet. And I thought, well, who's doing the vascular part of this? And then I look at it, and it was all people who I didn't recognize. And I've been kind of involved in this field for a long time. They were all interventionalists, what I probably shouldn't say pejoratively, but lesionologists. And the message was clear. Podiatrists were starting to recognize that more and more of their patients were ischemic. They wanted help with them. And for whatever reason in the broad community at large, they didn't have access to or weren't aware that there were vascular surgeons that really cared about this. And industry was pushing devices, right? Because there's all these new techniques we have. And we now can stick, like my partner Miguel showed you, can stick a tiny needle in an artery in the foot and wiggle a wire up backwards and get a blood vessel open. It's kind of a magical procedure, right? So, but that's all pushed by industry because we still don't know which of those techniques work for which patients. And I'm pretty sure those techniques don't last long enough for lots of patients. So anyway, the point was to marry podiatry and vascular surgery together. So we started with that simple concept. So when I was looking at a job actually at the University of Chicago, and that didn't take that. And then David called me one day and said, hey, what if I come to Arizona? So I talked to my chair, and he goes, well, you can do that. Sounds like a good idea, but I don't know anything about podiatry, so he'll be in your division. You figure it out. So as soon as I hired David, I get a call from one of my best friends who's the chief of orthopedics. And he says, what in the hell are you doing? You hired a goddamn podiatrist. And I said, well, John, we're just going to take care of diabetic feet. He's not going to do trauma. He's not going to mess up your other practice. Oh, just diabetic feet. That's okay. So nobody really cares. Kind of interesting. But this is a study that came out of Duke, I think, and it basically looked at the impact. And vascular surgeons like to think we save all these feet, but we save the ischemic feet, but we don't save that big iceberg that's diabetic feet. They're not all just ischemia, right? There's all these other things you have to do to actually not just get them to heal, but keep them healed. So this was a study that basically looked at if you saw a doctor plus a podiatrist in the last year, your risk of getting complications went way down. So that's prevention, which vascular surgeons don't do, right? We're the guys with our finger in the dike when the patient comes in and they already have a problem trying to save a foot at the end of the line, right? But what if you had people helping you up front to try to prevent some of that? So that's partly where podiatry comes in. And then this is how we developed our model, basically. I was really upset that people were focusing so much on the arterial anatomy and the lesion. It's like when the patient comes to you, they don't come to you with an angiogram and says, here's my anatomy. They come to you because they have a sore on their foot. And usually that sore doesn't hurt because they've lost the gift of pain, right? They have LOPS, loss of protective sensation. So they come in with a sore. And you have to sort out, is there ischemia present? Is there enough? I really have to correct it. If I have to correct it, what's the best way to correct it? But you also have to take care of the architecture of the foot. You may have to do some correction there. Maybe offloading is not going to be enough. And so how do you stage that limb and figure out how to deliver this care? And then, actually, it's sort of backwards. So before you assess the limb, you actually have to assess the patient first, right? Because the patient comes to you, not the limb. The limb doesn't walk into your office. The patient comes in. So you need to know about their support network, how functional they are, what their comorbidities are. Then you get to the limb status. And then when you do all that stuff of the subset that looks like they're going to need something to heal their wound, then you get into the anatomy. But our specialty, partly driven by great results with bypasses and identifying distal targets, and then pushed by lesionologists who were developing techniques to treat all these lesions, started focusing just on the arterial lesion, which I think was backwards. So I'll skip over that. So basically, we had a simple concept. Why not just put, so what we did was it took me 2 years. We got a clinic with two parallel hallways, and the vascular lab was in between. And we didn't care who got the patient first. If podiatry got the patient first or vascular got the patient first, and the same with inpatient consults. So same approach for inpatient and outpatient. We both saw the patient. And we basically used a precursor of Wi-Fi before we developed Wi-Fi to kind of sort them out. So they kind of fit into three groups. There's the obviously well-perfused patient who has a warm foot from neuropathy. They have a hole over a bony prominence. They've never been offloaded. They have a normal pulse. Almost no matter how you measure their blood flow, it's okay. They mostly need a podiatrist. And then you have the opposite of, somebody comes in with three dead toes. Maybe they actually have rest pain. They don't have any infection yet. And no matter how you measure their blood flow, they need a vascular surgeon first. And then at some point, maybe a podiatrist. But then you have all these patients in between. So we'd see them all, and we put them in three groups. And if they were a toe group, the toe team would take over and take care of that patient, and we'd periodically retest their blood flow. It was obviously ischemic. They got that corrected immediately. And then if they were in between, we took a variant approach. So if it was a smallish wound that hadn't been offloaded well and that we thought the care wasn't really standard and the blood supply wasn't bad, we would take really good care of that wound for a while, try to get the patient back. And if they were responding well over about 2 to 4 weeks, then we'd just keep treating the wound. If they got good care and were adherent and we were stalled, then we did something about the blood supply. So that was sort of, then when Wi-Fi came out, we now use that. So I've done this now in the Air Force, in Arizona. I'm trying to do it in two different settings in Houston. So part of the reason I came to Houston was because it has a huge population of patients with diabetes. And nobody in Houston has ever cared about lower limb stuff. It's been the center of the cardiac and aortic universe for 50 years. And the primitive system they had in place for foot care is shocking, actually. So we do the same thing. I partnered with a podiatrist I met when I first came there who wanted to do this for a long time. I had never found a vascular part. I finally hired him. He's a great doctor. He sees patients. We talk all the time. We try to stage every patient. Sorry? Oh, Jeff Ross, yeah. So the other thing that's really, really, really important is infection is the highest priority, not ischemia. So if they have infection, that needs to be controlled first, and it even needs to be drained. Even if the foot's ischemic, if there's drainable infection, you got to drain it. So we do that. We still, vascular does that, podiatry does that. It kind of depends on who's free. Then we get their ischemia worked up promptly and figure out where they are on the Wi-Fi spectrum. If they need blood flow, then they get blood flow. And then we talk together about who's going to manage this foot. Then the other key point to Wi-Fi that hasn't been appreciated is you should restage the patient. It's just like TNM for cancer. So many cancers now we used to operate on get chemo first or get radiation first. And then before the next stage is planned, after that round of chemo is done, patients restaged, right? So there used to be Nigra's protocol for anal rectal cancer. And so when that first started, I was a resident, patients would get the chemo, then you'd go in there and do an APR on the patient, an abdominal perineal resection, and people started noticing, hey, there's no cancer left. So that chemo worked for some cancers so well that the surgery was no longer necessary. So the same point here, and there's a paper that's just about to come out that was presented at the Southern. So they actually looked at the Wi-Fi score 1 month after you start treating the patient. That actually was a higher predictor of limb loss than what they were at baseline. So the point is, if you're doing everything right and you've revascularized me and you're still not getting anywhere, you may not be able to save that leg. So it's taken me 2 years, despite the fact that it was in my contract, but we just are about to start our clinic where we all work together. So we started out by just putting the podiatrist in the vascular clinic, but then you're mixing wound patients with carotid patients with other patients. It's not really efficient. And they had a separate wound clinic that was basically run by internists without any surgical involvement, and that wasn't working very well. So we finally got that all together. So the second thing I'm trying to do is Harris Health. So Harris Health is one of the largest indigent health systems in the country. So there's 1.2 million people out of the 6 million or so that live in the immediate Houston area that are eligible for Harris Healthcare, but they don't all come in until they have a problem. So they have a dedicated internist there who's an endocrinologist who started a wound clinic, does a really good job with it, but there's only one vascular surgery funded by entire Harris Health system. And so a lot of the patients, the traditional model for care there was nothing got done until it got really bad. They came in the emergency room, and the Baylor tradition was that general surgeons could do everything. So they would drain the person, give them one shot at the foot, and if that didn't work, they got a BK. So there were over 200 BKs the first year I got to Ben Taub in 1 year. So what we started there is I started meeting with them every month, and we now have an ID person, an ortho person, three vascular people, the vice chair of the department. So I started meeting with all these people to try to organize a limb service. So now we are using Wi-Fi triage in the ED, and patients are getting vascular assessment before they get sent home or before they get an amputation. So that's a whole other. And then one thing I didn't talk about was what I'm trying to do at Baylor. There's another issue is antibiotics. So the traditional model at St. Luke's was if you had any problem with your foot, you got admitted. And then whichever person happened to be consulted would do the best they could. So you might have an orthopedist consulted, you might have general surgery. If somebody thought there was ischemia, it might be cardiology, it would occasionally be vascular. There was no rhyme or reason to it. And a lot of patients got admitted, actually, they just had chronic neuropathic wounds with biofilm on them and didn't really need anything for admission. They just needed a coordinated workup. So we're trying to fix that. This is funny. So this I got from Dr. Montero Baker. So Vince mentioned nutrition. So this is the St. Luke's nutrition model. I'm sure this patient's diabetic. This is the McDonald's that's in the St. Luke's Hospital. It's a 24-story building. It's huge. And then the point of all these things, it's the somebody just cleaned the floor, which is kind of funny to do right in the middle of the day. But these are all the barriers you have to go through to get resources from your hospital to try to do this stuff. And the only way you can do it is you have to the hospital actually gets this as a problem. But to try to convince them to do something about it, it's really hard because it takes resources. So you can't quit. You just have to keep beating on them. And it also helps you if you're not beating on them by yourself. So if you get an ID person, a couple podiatrists, a couple vascular surgeons, and you get a group of us, say, we have a coordinated way, we're going to avoid admitting some of these patients. The ones that get admitted will actually get in a coordinated workup so they don't spend forever in the hospital. We can do better. So we just started the Save the Extremity Program step. And Ed Olmos was actually nice enough to come to DEF CON that we had in Houston for the first time. So anyway, I mentioned for Ben Taub, I was meeting with him every month. So I went to the first M&M there. Ken Maddox still runs that. And I flipped through this. They call them protocols, but every service has a list of all the cases they did for the week. So I would flip through every week, and I would look at anybody that had a toe amputation, a foot debridement, a BK, an AK, an angiogram, a leg bypass. And what was stunning to me, so Houston is the most diverse city in the country. So over 30% of the population was born in another country. So there's huge ethnic groups of all varieties. But by far and away, the most common patient that was threatened with limb loss was Hispanic. So there's a lot of working people in the Houston area that are Hispanic, and their insurance ends up taking them there. So in the context of going once a month to meet with these people, this PCORI grant comes up. So we submitted a huge grant for patient-centered outcomes research to look at ethnic and racial disparities, which I thought Harris Health would be a perfect substrate for, really. And we got turned down for that. But they liked the idea, and they said, look, you're not really looking at ethnic disparities. You're looking at how to design a healthcare system, which is really what we're trying to do, right? We're trying to take the resources that we have in Harris Health and figure out how to use them to get patients the kind of care that they really need. So we're going to try to use Wi-Fi to stage patients, and then we're going to try to branch out and have some of the patients with lower risk limbs be treated in their primary care clinic to offload the centralized wound care clinic they have now. So that's part of what that is. But anyway, I think I covered all that stuff. So in Arizona, basically, this is what we were able to do. This was when I hired David and one other podiatrist. These are the monthly clinic volumes. So we got up to seeing 10 to 12,000 patient visits a year. And Tucson's not a big place. Pima County is only a million. And so that's not individual patients, but that's patient visits. So we did that in about a three-year period. We looked at what happened before and afterwards. So this speaks to the neuroischemic thing. So one-third of these patients over 4 years ended up being revascularized, which is pretty high. We did endo first on about 64% of them. And we already had a pretty low amputation rate, but it got even lower. And what also happened was we increased the number of non-urgent procedures. So we were doing prophylactic things to offload patients, to like pan-med head resections. I never would have done those before I met David. So by working together, we improved the care for the patients. Now, the final thing I want to... So you got to set up this system to take care of a chronic disease, right? And that's not how our healthcare system is designed. Our healthcare system was designed to take care of disasters, right? So we do great with trauma, like that case Vince showed. Best trauma care in the world. We have Children's Hospital, we have Ben Taub, and if you're injured in Houston, you get first-rate care. But if you have a chronic disease, not so hot, right? We treat a chronic disease like it's an emergency. So what do? We wait till the problem's really bad, and when the patient gets in the ED and they have a stage 4 limb, we're trying to save it. That doesn't make sense. But the final message is this. This is from Stefan Moorbach's group. And so in Europe, the advantage Europe has is they have patients in healthcare systems, so they can actually design a system that works. That's why the limb salvage rates are so good in Italy, for example, because they see patients right away and they get triaged. So this was from Moorbach's paper. And basically, when we take care of these patients and you show that heel foot, that's not a cure. They're in remission, right? Because they still have diabetes. They still have neuropathy. Even if you corrected their ischemia, there's no revascularization that's immortal. So they're always at risk to having a recurrent problem. So just because you fixed them the first time, if you don't have a system that can help maintain that, then the recurrence rate, I think, here was over 90% at 10 years. So for the patients that we keep alive longer with diabetes, you're not done with them. So your limb salvage center is actually going to have to expand because you're going to have to start following these at-risk patients to prevent recurrence. Because if you don't, we're going to, Mike's talked about this, but the epidemic of restenosis, that doesn't even get to the epidemic of recurrent lesions in these patients. So it's a big problem. So I think the message is you got to find somebody to work with. So Dr. Ross and I actually operate together. Sometimes it sounds kind of weird, but if I've revascularized a foot and I was maybe the one that drained it because I was on call, I kind of like to be around to see what's going on. And we teach each other stuff and we learn from each other. And sometimes one of us will recognize, we had a guy in the hospital that Miguel and I revascularized four times. He had primarily distal disease, wasn't really a bypass candidate. And his foot just wasn't making it. And I thought, I'm sure this is as good a blood flow as we can get. And I went back and touched up this little minor pedal stenosis. And finally, we take him to OR to debride him. And there's a pocket of undrained infection there. We'd both missed it for like a week. We were seeing this guy every day. And I was fixated on the fact that it wasn't responding because the blood flow wasn't adequate. And the reason was there was still infection. So the point of that is we all make mistakes. The other point is if you work together, you're more likely to find them. So working together is good for the patient. And it's really good professionally. I have so much more fun when I have a group of people I'm working with and working for the same goal and we're trying to do better. So thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.